Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello! I've got some exciting news to share with you all at Retrition Plus, which, as many of you may know, is my evidence-based supplements company. We've relaunched, and there are four incredible products on offer: the Daily Vegan Multi-Still, a pregnancy multivitamin, and an adult's vitamin D daily spray. But here's another new one, the Kids Daily Vitamin D Drops. At Retrition Plus, of course, the approach I've always had is that it's rooted in science. It's not in fleeting trends. We will only ever partner in the fact that we want to achieve a healthier, more balanced you. We're equally passionate about the well-being of our planet. So for me, Retrition Plus is transparent. We are sustainable and responsible. You know, our approach to well-being is at the core of everything that we do. Our supplements are designed so you can live and breathe a healthy diet and balanced lifestyle. I developed this idea in lockdown. I've had my children, and that's where the passion, I suppose, really comes. If you guys want to go and check out the range at Retrition Plus and our new products, which I know are going to help so many people, just head over to RetritionPlus.com, and you can also check us out on social media at Retrition Plus. Hello, welcome back to season 16 of Food for Thought. I can't actually believe it. I can't even believe we're on season 16. And I'm back in the studio here in London. It's fantastic. We've got the most incredible lineup of guests that are going to be bringing you the most fascinating conversations with nutrition, health, and wellness fields. We've definitely gone above and beyond, guys, this time. I want to make sure that we have all the best information out there to equip you with the latest scientific evidence and research, so you can, of course, live and breathe a healthy lifestyle, supporting you to make informed decisions, because after all, you're the ones that make the decisions with your life. A little bit about me, for those of you that don't know, I am Rhiannon Lambert, a registered nutritionist, Sunday Times best-selling author of The Science of Nutrition, many other books there too, the founder of Harley Street Clinic Retrition and the evidence-based supplements company Retrition Plus. Over the next few weeks, my guests and I aim to use science-based research. So we're going to sort fact from fiction. There is an overwhelming amount of confusing health information out there. So join us to dispel everything that remains misunderstood within the world of wellness. And as always, thank you so much. Gosh, we couldn't do it without you wonderful listeners. Honestly, the messages I receive, the support, the love, it's incredible. And I can't wait to hear what you think of the new season. So let's go. Our guest today is an expert in all things sleep and insomnia. Hallelujah. I've been so excited to do another episode on sleep. There is no doubt that a good night's sleep can definitely set you up for a busy day. I know I feel absolutely horrendous when I've been up with the kids or I haven't slept well. My whole day has changed. My mood has changed. And there are so many people in the UK that struggle to get a good quality sleep or even enough. And how do we know how much is enough for you? These are all questions I want to ask today. So there's so much advice out there about how to get the best sleep. It can actually be a bit of a minefield and quite stressful to navigate. So thank goodness I've got Lindsay Browning here. She is a chartered psychologist and a neuroscientist who holds a PhD from the University of Oxford in insomnia. Who knew? What a fascinating PhD to have. She is the author of Navigating Sleeplessness and founder of her sleep consultancy and therapy practice, Trouble Sleeping. I think I need to book in with you. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No, oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I was reading your credentials. Like, wow, what an amazing area to study. How on earth did you get into the area of sleep?
Well, I studied psychology at my first degree, and then my I did a master's in neuroscience, and sleep at the time, well, still somewhat, was such an unknown field, a bit like space, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, studying the brain, neuroscience, and then sleep was just such an interesting subset of that. So I just sort of fell into it. And, you know, when you're doing a doctorate, you have to sort of pick a research field that everyone in the university is studying. And there was a professor, Alison Harvey, who was studying that. So, yeah, I just worked with her. And my doctorate was specifically studying and treating insomnia at the University of Oxford.
Wow.
Wow, wow, wow. Well, it's going to help a lot of people, I think, today's episode, because we hear about people struggling with sleep all the time, don't we? You know, whether it's like myself as a parent, you just don't get any, or it's the quality of it, the quantity you're able to get. Some people work night shifts, some people don't. It's what on earth are the top tips for a good night's sleep? Let's start there.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's making the time to sleep. I think that's the biggest reason. Although we all know that the recommendations are we should get somewhere between 7 and 9 hours sleep a night. Most people don't get that much sleep. And for some people, it's because they can't sleep. And that's insomnia, when they want to sleep, but they can't. But for most people, it's because they don't have time to sleep. So the basic top tip for sleep is to go to bed so that you can get enough sleep. Because if you go to bed at midnight and have to get up at 6, there is literally no way you're going to get the recommended amount of sleep.
No.
So that would be like my biggest top tip. But it's really hard to do that when life is so busy. Mm. And then especially post COVID and the sort of sleep procrastination, which revenge sleep procrastination, where people deliberately don't go to sleep because they want to get some time for themselves, especially when we're working at home and we're parents and our entire life is taken up by someone else. We go to bed.
Catch up with all your life.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, I just need a little bit of time to just scroll through rubbish on social media.
I get into bed and I'm like, right, who haven't I messaged my friends in ages? Mm-hmm. And my WhatsApp's got so many unread messages. And that's the only time of day as a parent you get a chance to even look at your phone like that.
Absolutely. So you go to bed with all the good intentions of going to bed at 10, but 11:30, you're still scrolling.
And let's discuss productivity, because surely, I mean, I'd anecdotally find that if I do go to bed earlier, if I'm able to, I am just 10 times more productive. So the work, I've realised this now, writing books, there's no point me writing books at the evening after the kids have gone to bed. It's just not as good as during the day. Is there a bit of research behind that?
Well, that suggests to me that you're a lark.
Ah, okay.
So like larks and owls.
I like singing. Oh, okay. I'm the lark.
That could be a singing thing, but no. Yeah. Larks and owls is kind of like a circadian rhythm. So we all have a circadian rhythm, which means when our body, what time our body thinks it is, basically. And some people tend to be ones who, when the alarm goes off, they're maybe awake before it and they're up bright and early and they're getting on with the day. And by the time 9 o'clock comes, they just want to go to bed.
Yeah.
And other people who, getting up in the morning is an absolute nightmare. Teenagers are a typical example of that. But when the evening comes, they don't want to go to bed. They're still going.
I've got friends like that. They're so awake at night.
Yeah. So lots of people are in the middle. They're just, typical. But the extremes are, larks and owls. And if someone is a lark, that means that they are more alert, more bright and early in the day. And therefore, once the kids have gone to bed, your body is not okay to be doing difficult, complex tasks. If you were an owl, obviously metaphorically not actually an owl, then you're doing all that book writing first thing in the morning is going to be really difficult. Whereas once kids have gone to bed, your brain is still going really a million miles an hour and you don't want to stop. So some of it is about understanding who you are and your sort of chronotype and working with that as well.
Which is so important. Yeah, I guess that is my chronotype. And I'm sure a lot of people will be on in the middle or, like you said, each end of the spectrum. And I sometimes find as well, when you get to around 3-4 o'clock, oh my goodness, my focus is just already out the window. Is that to do naturally with cortisol levels or the hormones getting ready for sleep? Already,
so if you're talking
early?
About a sort of the afternoon dip, we all have our bodies naturally want us to have a sleep just after lunch, like a siesta. And, if you look at when it's easy to fall asleep, it's difficult to fall asleep at 9 in the morning, typically, but it's very easy to fall asleep at 1 in the afternoon, 2 in the afternoon. And again, it's hard to fall asleep at 7 p.m, but it's easy to fall asleep at 10, 11, because that's when our body thinks we should be sleeping. So our body thinks we should have a nap just after lunch.
I love that. That's why children nap.
Mm-hmm. Well, children nap because they
can't stay awake.
Yeah, they need a lot more sleep. But yeah, that when we nap, and even into adulthood, there's tons of research to suggest that embracing that, having a bit of a catch-up sleep, a nap just after lunch, when your body wants you to have a sleep is so good for you. So you might find that if you're flagging at 3-4 in the afternoon, if you could find a way to have a little top-up nap, like a 20-minute nap just after lunch, you might not be feeling
that
sluggish.
The time interests me because I've had a lot of different theories of how long a nap should be. Mm-hmm. Should it be 10 minutes, 20 minutes? Should you do a full hour? What are your thoughts on that?
Brilliant. So the point is, we have these things called sleep cycles.
Yes.
So we tend to have different parts of sleep. You have, sorry, this is a long answer because
it's
complex.
No, it's good. You've got to discuss REM sleep.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when we sleep, we have different parts of sleep. We have three main different parts of sleep. We have light sleep, deep sleep and REM sleep, yes, or rapid eye movement sleep. And these different parts of sleep go in cycles. So approximately every hour and a half-ish, we'll go through light sleep, deep sleep and dream and REM sleep. And that will start again. So if you have a nap, what you want to do ideally is to have a full sleep cycle, which is like an hour and a half-ish.
Oh, wow.
Or just have a short sleep that's about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, maybe 15, 20, 25 minutes. That means you'll stay in light sleep when you wake up. Now, having between 20 minutes and an hour and a half isn't really recommended for a nap, because what you'll do is you'll find yourself waking up after an hour's sleep from within deep sleep.
And it's grumpy. It feels horrible.
Exactly. And what the reason is, our body, we have a thing called like sort of sleep inertia. Our bodies want us to finish a full sleep cycle. And if we wake up halfway through, your body is desperately trying to pull you back into being asleep. So if you have an hour's nap, the positive is you've had an hour's sleep, which is hugely beneficial. But the negative is, at that moment you wake up, you'll feel dreadful.
Mm.
And of course, if we want to take an afternoon nap, we don't want to waste that time feeling sluggish afterwards. It's not a problem. It just means that it'll take you a little while to sort of get rid of that sleep inertia,
yeah,
and feel more bright and alert. That's why we recommend a 20-minute nap, or if your boss allows and life allows, an hour
sadly,
and a half would be great.
No time in the day with the work. But I find that so interesting. And another thing I hear a lot, colloquial people saying, is that, oh, I've had a nap, I won't sleep tonight now. How true is that?
Well, it depends how much sleep you've had. So I sort of have an analogy with food a lot of the time. So we have a 7 to 9 hour sleep need every 24 hours, say. So if you're taking a lot of, if you're having some of that sleep during the day, you won't need as much at night. So people on the continent who do have regular siestas, like a couple of hours at lunchtime, say, which is very typical, they'll sleep maybe 5 hours a night. And you might think, oh my goodness, 5 hours is not enough sleep. But you've got to add on the sleep you had at lunchtime. So if you've had a nap, if it's about a 20-minute nap, that's a very small amount of sleep. And especially if it was just after lunch,
yeah,
miles from bedtime, it shouldn't affect your sleep needs that much. But if you have a nap later in the day, or a much, much longer nap, like an hour and a half nap, for example, you're not going to need as much sleep that night.
So have the Mediterraneans got it right and we've got it wrong? And I always thought it was about having 8 hours in a row rather mm-hmm. than it being broken up around the day. So that's fascinating.
Yeah, so the point is, we do better when we sleep when our body thinks it's nighttime.
Yeah.
Which our circadian rhythm controls that. So our circadian rhythm says, oh, we should sleep at night, be awake during the day. So we definitely, it's better for our bodies to have the majority of our sleep at night when our body thinks we're asleep and we should be asleep. But that little like siesta time just after lunch fits in with our natural biology, how our body works. So it doesn't need to be in one block, but if you can have the majority of your sleep at nighttime, that's better.
Amazing. I think that's really helpful for people listening. Also gives them hope, because for different situations, work, lifestyle, there are options for you that can still perhaps undo any of the damage of not getting sleep, which we can touch on later. Now, let's talk about the science of the brain, so how it works with sleep, because a lot of people buy into melatonin pills. I know mm-hmm. you're not really in this country, but it's popular thing. And are they effective?
Well, that's a great question, because in the UK, which is one of the few countries in the world where you can't just pop to the shop and buy melatonin, and you know, we could debate whether that's a good thing or not, but I like to help people to sleep well without needing to rely on medication. Now, melatonin isn't a sleeping pill, like a prescription sleeping pill, and it works in a completely different way. So melatonin tells your body when to sleep. So we go back to that circadian rhythm, which tells your body when it's nighttime, when it's time to be awake. Melatonin tells your body, yes, we should be sleeping now.
And is that produced more in the dark?
Yes, and our brains produce it naturally when it's dark. Mm-hmm. And when it's bright light, our body doesn't produce melatonin. Mm-hmm. And that's why things like bright blue light, screens can mess up your sleep. Melatonin. Because if you're exposing yourself to lots of bright light, your body naturally will say, ah, oh, it's not nighttime. You're in bed, you're scrolling through the phone. Your brain goes, oh, no, it can't be bedtime because look at all this bright light we're looking at. Let's not produce melatonin. So some people take melatonin supplements thinking it will help their sleep. But the reality is, if you're naturally producing melatonin yourself, you don't need any supplements. It's like if you have a vitamin C deficiency, taking more vitamin C is going to do nothing.
I mean, my question on this is it even effective taking melatonin pill? Does it reach the pathway it needs to reach? That's what I'm really interested in, I think. Yeah, it's because back in the day, I used to be a singer before I embarked upon my nutritional science degrees, and I did a lot of traveling around the world. I was really lucky. And one of my one of the members in my band at the time, we were opera quartet, she was from Vancouver. Oh, I've got my melatonin pills. I remember her so clearly. She was so funny. She's like, I've got my pills. Does everyone want one? You know, like when we got on the plane to do these gigs. So I'm fascinated to know if it's like a placebo. Does it even work? And why it's not available in the UK?
So the point is, melatonin tells your body when to sleep. So with things like jet lag, which is exactly what your Vancouverian friend was talking about, melatonin can be extremely effective because when we experience jet lag, we're trying to sleep at a time when our body thinks we should be awake. So it's very hard to sleep. If you take a melatonin supplement, your body isn't naturally producing melatonin itself because it thinks it's daytime. So you take a melatonin supplement capsule and your body has all this melatonin and you can sleep more easily. So when people are jet lagged, potentially working shifts, or if they have a neurological deficiency of melatonin, like people who are blind because they don't have
the bright light exposure.
It depends how you're blind. If it's cortical, like if you're blind because your brain can't process it, or if your eyes are faulty.
Right.
If you're blind where your eyes can't process the light, you can't produce melatonin naturally at the right time because you don't know what brightness is and not. So blind people often have to take melatonin. Or kids with ADHD and autism can have a deficiency in melatonin.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, so there are some situations where melatonin is necessary. And in the over 55s, as we get older, we can sometimes start to produce less melatonin. So on the NHS, GPs can prescribe circadian for the elderly. However, for neurotypical, younger people, there's no reason to have melatonin supplements because it's very unlikely that you have a deficiency. Melatonin as a sleep aid for insomnia has a great placebo effect.
Yeah.
And that's where it's really strong, meaning that if I gave you some Smarties and said, these are going to really help you sleep tonight, and you it would help you sleep because you're like, oh, great, I've had Lindsay's Smarties. I'm going to sleep really well.
Yeah, I've got magic potions.
So, yeah, it depends. So the melatonin, it's very effective if you're not producing melatonin at the right time because of a neurological problem or because of jet lag. But if you are in a typical 9-to-5 job and nothing's changed, melatonin is highly unlikely to be helpful.
So it's really good to know that it is there for people that need it, because I've read as well that sleep deficiency affects our lifespan. How true is that? I mean, is it true we need 7 to 9 hours?
Well, science suggests that people should get somewhere between 7 to 9 hours sleep regularly, meaning not a feast and famine, not neglecting it during the week and then catching up at the weekend. And that sleeping well for those amounts of hours regularly helps to increase your lifespan. It helps to decrease your risk of certain types of cancers, of dementia, of heart attacks, of stroke, of diabetes, of obesity, of depression, anxiety. The list goes on. There is no getting away from the fact that sleeping sufficiently regularly is fantastic for our health. But the problem is, most people know this, and for some people they need to be told it in a bit more forcefully because they're not prioritising their sleep. Just like with nutrition, as you talked. We all know we should eat healthily, but how many people don't, despite the fact they know it? So the same with sleep. Now, the trouble is, and again, a parallel with nutrition, if someone knows that they need that amount of sleep and they're trying to get it, but they can't because they have insomnia, ramming down their throat, oh my goodness, if you don't sleep well, you're going to die a horrible death, and makes it even worse.
Yeah.
Just like if somebody has anorexia, the last thing I need to be told is the dangers of obesity.
No, we're talking mental health. I mean, if you describe insomnia first for our listeners, so they know how to define, and obviously you should speak to your GP if you have insomnia, right?
Definitely. So insomnia is not getting no sleep whatsoever, because sometimes people think that's what it means. It means you have trouble falling asleep, so it takes you maybe more than 30 minutes to fall asleep, or you wake up in the night and you can't get back to sleep again. It takes you more than 30 minutes to maybe fall asleep, back to sleep again. Or you're waking up much earlier than your ideal waking time, and that you have a problem during the day coping. So it doesn't matter if it takes you ages to fall asleep, but once you're asleep and you wake up the next morning, you feel fine. That's not insomnia. That's suggesting that you're going to bed too early. Whereas if you're trying to fall asleep, but you don't get enough sleep, and then the next day you feel tired, you're not able to cope, that's insomnia. And absolutely, someone should speak to their GP, and they really should, because loads of people don't speak to their GP because they think, well, all they're going to say is give me sleeping pills and I know they're not good for me. But there is actually really good treatment for insomnia. So insomnia could be caused by a deficiency of something. So a thyroid issue or an iron issue, something else going on which a GP could pick up and resolve. Or if it's a more sort of psychological insomnia, which is more common, meaning someone's really stressed, their brain's just like won't switch off at night. Mm. They know they want to sleep, but they're so stressed about it.
Anxiety as well. I know post children, I can only speak obviously from the parenthood angle, but the anxiety of sleeping, if your baby's sleeping and you're used to them being awake, it's really difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. So all these factors can make it really, really hard to fall asleep, even though you want to and you're trying.
And you feel horrendous.
Really horrendous, and worrying about sleep constantly.
Nauseous as well, I've noticed, when you don't sleep.
You have jittery, headaches, body aches, feeling nauseous, all of these things. But the GP can suggest that you have CBTI, which is cognitive behavioural therapy for insomnia. Now, it sounds like CBT for depression, but it's specifically for insomnia, CBTI. And it's a treatment which actually helps you to relearn how to sleep. And it's so effective, it doesn't need any drugs. So, people should definitely speak to their doctor about that.
What a fascinating area. And do you have a stat off the top of your head, how many people in the population experience insomnia? I'm sure it's huge.
No, it is. And I absolutely did have a stat. And I was writing
know.
It yesterday.
I put you on the spot.
You did. I think it's like...
It's like
30%. 30% of people. One in three in the UK.
It doesn't surprise me, because it's also something that's so flippantly mentioned. Oh, I've got insomnia, without obviously the actual insomnia. But for a lot of people, it is so serious. Yeah. And is it something that comes on more as we age?
Actually, interestingly, kind of, yeah. So about one in three people will experience sort of poor sleep during the year. But for it to be insomnia ongoing for a long period of time, it's more like sort of 1 in 10, I believe. So the incidence of insomnia tends to increase with age. And also, quite interestingly, it's women report 40% more insomnia than men.
Is it during the menopause? I've read that menopause massively impact. Why is that? Is it the drop of estrogen? Does it impact sleep?
So women have much more risk of insomnia from puberty onwards. So it's not just at menopause. But of course, from puberty onwards, what are women faced with? Changing hormones monthly. So when
constantly.
Every month their hormone levels change. When you get pregnant, your hormone levels change. When you stop being pregnant, your hormone levels change. Mm-hmm. When you go through perimenopause, premenopause, postmenopause, there is constant flux of hormones. And hormones have such an impact on sleep regulation, but not just directly on sleep, but also on mood.
Yeah.
And of course, anxiety. And when we are anxious, we don't sleep, because it's about that. When you're anxious, when you're fearful, of course, your body won't want you to sleep, because it wants you to stay awake.
A survival mechanism.
Absolutely, to deal with the problem. So, especially when people go through menopause and they have those anxiety surges, as well as physical problems with sleep, such as the night sweats. You wake up, you're covered in sweat
around that time of month as well. I get night sweats around that time of month since having my children. I know it's the hormone fluctuations.
Absolutely. And when you're pregnant, physically it's uncomfortable to sleep. So there are all sorts of issues that men, or people born as male, don't have to deal with.
I know, I've got two boys. They don't know how lucky they are. I think it's so important we have these discussions, because I feel that as women, if we're open and we talk about this and we know what to expect and we know we're not alone to start with, because even just having that touch on anxiety, I'm thinking, I'm sure everyone listening is like, oh, that's me. Mm-hmm. I do that. I catastrophize before bed, or I'm there in my own thoughts. I can't switch off.
Yeah.
I think it's so common. And obviously, as a nutritionist, I'm fascinated in the dietary area as well, linking to sleep. And we've obviously looked at carbohydrates, the importance of those with production of serotonin. I don't know if you could give us, I want to hear from you, your dietary tips, if any.
Well, there's things like intermittent fasting, I'm not sure how, what you feel about that, but that's very big and in at the moment. But things like sleep and hunger aren't best friends,
no,
I would say.
Oh, you can't sleep if you're hungry.
Exactly. So the point is, as much as they're probably, you know, and I'm not a nutritionist, that lots of people, evidence suggesting that intermittent fasting is really great for you, if your main problem is insomnia, you can't fall asleep and you haven't eaten anything.
By the way, we're not fans of fasting here. Okay, it works for some, not for others. You don't need to tread on eggshells with me on that. I'm not a one-size-fits-all person
on this podcast. And that's what I feel about sleep as well.
Yeah.
Because if you do want to do that and you sleep fine, brilliant, go for it. But if you're going to bed and you haven't eaten for hours and hours and hours, then your body is going to be on edge. You're going to be anxious because, you know, as cavemen, we are motivated to do something about hunger, because when we were cavemen and we all sat in a cave, if we were hungry but sleepy, we just thought, oh, I'm hungry, but I can't be bothered. I'm just have a sleep. Mm. Humanity would have died out thousands and thousands of years ago of hunger, of starvation, because no one could be bothered to find food.
Yeah.
So when we're hungry, our body goes, oh, we should do something about this. We should go and hunt for a deer or forage for berries or go to the fridge. So if you're going to bed hungry, it's going to impact your sleep. And also not just getting to sleep, but waking up in the middle of the night. And people often, they'll wake up at 2-3 in the morning, go downstairs and have a warm glass of milk. That will help go back to sleep again. However, I don't want people to eat in the middle of the night.
No.
Because you're,
Your digestion.
Yeah, it shuts down overnight. It's linked to your circadian rhythm. So therefore, if you are waking up in the middle of the night hungry, that's a sign you need to eat something before bed so that it will give you that slow release sustained energy through the night to help you go back to sleep again.
We say 2 to 3 hours, have your last big meal before bed.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. And some people, you know, I've noticed that, again, I've only witnessed it raising my children, the importance of food and sleep.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about it. You'll have a full tummy and then you'll go to sleep. It's so true, isn't it?
Yeah, but soporific, that word soporific. What happens on Christmas Day after Christmas lunch? We all fall asleep.
Yeah. Because
now, there's a difference between, you know, like you said, 2 to 3 hours before bed, because you don't want to have a massive meal right before bed.
And we're obviously so privileged, right, that we've got access to food.
Absolutely.
Of course, there are people in the world that don't.
Mm-hmm. And especially the cost of living crisis.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not even just a Western, you know, privileged society situation.
No, exactly. And I really think if we can hammer home something in this conversation is, if we have access to good nutrition, let's try and maximise it and let's help our sleep a little bit, because it's so important. But if you have any tips then for people with insomnia that are listening right now, what would be your top 3 tips for them?
Sure. So if you are going to bed and your brain is really, really busy and you're anxious, it's about addressing that. So often, that's the number one reason people tell me they can't sleep, is because they lie down in bed and their brain just starts whirring. And that's because your brain has to do that thinking. You know, people try to stop, you know, empty the mind, or try and have tablets, or just try and, you know, get rid
listen
of all those thoughts.
Listen to like an audio thing.
But the point is, your brain is having these thoughts because they're important. You can't keep just pushing them away. You know, you're a busy working mum, myself too. We're busy all day long. We get up in the morning, we have to get the kids sorted, we've got to get them to school, we've got to do our work.
There's no time for your own thoughts.
There is no time for anything.
No, there isn't.
And then you lie down in bed, turn the lights off, it's dark, it's quiet, and your brain goes, bing!
That's it. That's
Let's
it.
Let's think about everything. Yeah. Let's think about that email we didn't send to so-and-so. Or, oh my goodness, I can't believe that she said that to me and I should have said that in reply.
For me, I've got this terrible habit also of... I don't normally divulge this many personal areas, but I think it might be helpful for our listeners. I am that person that doesn't think happy thoughts sometimes for bed. I worry about things a lot. I'm a worrier, so I'll be thinking of the state of the planet, or I'll be thinking of all these things that, you're right, we don't have time to think about in the day, so it pops up.
Yeah, and this is really common with children as well, because what do we do as parents? We tuck them into bed, and as we're tucking them in, we say, oh, and how was your day at school, Jimmy?
Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't great, Mummy. I was bullied by... John, oh, that's a shame. Good night. And off you go. And then,
oh no, I don't. I'm not looking forward to that stage.
And then the kid is just thinking about all this stuff.
Yeah.
So what we have to do is, for our model to our children and for us, is to make time during the day to do that thinking.
Mm.
We can't just block it off or just pretend it's not there.
Mm.
So we can call it worry time. We can call it journaling. We can call it, you know, there are also like gratitude journals. Whatever works for you. Find some time, make some time. And all we're talking about is 15 minutes in the day, 1-5. Early in the day, ideally sort of 6, 7, 8 p.m. So it's a couple of hours before bed. And ideally, I say in the evening, because you want the day to have happened. Because if you do it first thing in the morning, That's easy. But what if you have an argument with someone during the day? Mm. You need some time to reflect on that. So find 15 minutes when you're not scrolling through whatever or watching Netflix and write. Write down a piece of paper, whatever is worrying you or whatever is on your mind. You might not feel...
Can people
there is
type
anything.
It on the yeah, absolutely. Writing? So, I'm a writer as well. I love old school. I know. I can't process about writing.
Yeah, but yeah, people younger people type. Like absolutely. I'm old. as I tell people, you know, if you're of
the
younger generation,
it will be on the. Tablets.
They won't even have a pen. I mean, they'll oh, be gosh. Like, "What even is a pen?" Mm. So yes, typing is fine. The science suggests that physically, the act of writing with a pen is most effective,
yeah.
But I'm sure that that's going to change as generations come through. But yeah, it's just about brain dumping. Think of it as writing down your worries, writing down whatever you did today. It's just a case of getting stuff from your brain out
that.
Of your brain, and then when you lie down in bed, your brain will be clearer.
It's like a light bulb moment for me just sitting here now thinking, of course, we all need this reminder that your yeah. brain has to process what's happened that day,
yeah.
and all of us just shut it off. Because we don't think we have time. Well, we don't. It's hard
yeah,
to find
we don't make
time for it.
And that's what dreams are as well. Our dreaming sleep is our brain's way of processing emotion and what's been going on in our life.
So there is some truth then behind these people that can interpret dreams. Maybe.
Well, interpret dreams in so much as if you're dreaming about something very stressful, maybe there's something very stressful happening in your life. I would say there is very limited science to suggest yeah. that if you dream of a red balloon, you're going to go on a trip somewhere the next day. But yeah, dreaming sleep is massively important. It's our brains, like, it's like free therapy overnight. So again, if you are having lots of difficult, emotional, uncomfortable dreams, often if people are going through a hard time, these dreams will be, they won't be pleasant. They'll be full of, packed with negative emotion, and people will wake up a lot during the night because these dreams are too much, too big. Yeah. So rather than, you know, people say, how can I stop dreaming? You can't stop dreaming, but what you can do is make time during the day to process these emotional issues that you're clearly going through so that your brain won't have to do it for you in the middle of the night, whether that be writing therapy or speaking to someone, like in post-traumatic stress disorder, yeah. PTSD.
Yes.
Talk to someone, deal with that during the day, and then those terrible repeated nightmares will stop.
So that's the most amazing tip for people with insomnia, I think, possible. And it really made me think, what about when you wake up in the morning and you remember your dream and other times you don't? Does that mean you've woken up in the REM cycle?
Yeah, exactly. So, remember, I spoke at the beginning about what is a sleep cycle. So a sleep cycle is approximately an hour and a half, like 90 to 110 minutes. It's vague. But basically, we go light sleep, deep sleep, REM sleep. And REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, is the part when we tend to dream. And then it will repeat again in like, kind of like waves across the night. Now, a couple of really important things about this. First of all, are in between each sleep cycle, this is probably, if you're listening, this is one of the most important things to take away.
Okay, take this away,
yeah,
everyone.
This is important.
Pens and paper out, make a note.
Between each sleep cycle, you'll wake up. Every single person on the planet wakes up about every hour and a half. But the point is, you'll only remember waking up if you're awake for at least a couple of minutes, because it takes a couple of minutes to process that memory of waking up, store it in your brain to remember it the next morning. Now, I'm going to come back to the dreaming thing, but
yeah,
no,
it's good, it's good.
Now, this is important because when you're 21, you probably go to bed at 10:30 or 11, wake up at 7 the next morning and don't remember waking up. And you'll think, oh, I slept through the night solidly in one solid block. What a great night's sleep. And then you get older and you have children and they wake you up.
Yeah.
Or you get older and you wake up and you worry about things in the night. Or you wake up because you need the loo. Or you wake up because you have a hormonal flush, you know, a night sweat. And people think, oh no, this is terrible. My sleep has suddenly become fragmented, disjointed. It's bad quality sleep because I'm waking up in the night. And I need to sleep like I did when I was 18, 21, and sleep in a solid block. And I say to them, that's literally impossible. No one sleeps in a solid block. They just will be awake for 30 seconds to a minute, adjust the covers, roll over, go back to sleep again, and not remember it. But their sleep was still fragmented. And that's so important because when you're waking up in the night and you think that's a problem, then you wake up, oh no, I've woken up, this is terrible, my sleep's bad quality. Of course, you're anxious, you're stressed, you won't go back to sleep again. So don't worry about waking up in the night. As long as you go back to sleep again, it's not a problem. So back to the dreaming thing. When we wake up, which we do throughout the night, if we wake up from REM sleep, or from dreaming sleep, then we are likely to remember having a dream. If we wake up from light sleep or deep sleep, we won't remember dreaming, probably because we're unlikely to be dreaming in those parts of sleep. Mm. So people who think, oh, I never dream, they do, they absolutely do. They just don't wake up from that part of sleep. And people who always dream just tend to happen to wake up from REM sleep. If you never dream and you really want to remember your dreams, then what you can do is set your waking alarm,
of course,
20 minutes earlier, half an hour earlier. See if you can catch yourself in dreaming sleep. And wow, then you're likely to...
And quickly write it down, because we forget it. Yeah, we forget absolutely. The dream. You know, yeah. I know I woke up this morning thinking, in the middle of a dream. That's why I asked. I'm sure I did, because I remember thinking, I thought, oh, I've slept through the night last night. I was like, yay, that one of those rare moments where I've slept. Obviously, I hadn't, but... Wow, but I've forgotten already what on earth I was even dreaming about.
But when you go to sleep tonight and your brain starts going into a similar sleepy phase, you might find the dream comes back
yeah.
to you.
Wow, love it. Now, we've got so many questions for you, Lindsay, from our listeners. It was hard to even write down which ones to put in. Based on what we've discussed, let's start with this one from Ian, who said, I don't feel rested when I wake up. How can I get a deeper sleep? So this is obviously, it's a bit mathematical,
question.
Isn't it now? You've just said about timing.
Okay, so that's a few things in there I'd like to unpick.
Yes.
So people obsess about getting more deep sleep. This is a really common thing. Now, again, like if you weren't paying attention, this is another important thing. Deep sleep doesn't equal good sleep. Think about...
Okay.
It's really important. Think about sleep and the different parts of sleep, light sleep, deep sleep, dreaming sleep, like a plate of food. Now, deep sleep is like broccoli. Yes, it's good for you. Absolutely. You know more than anyone. If you only ate broccoli, would you be healthy?
No.
No, you'd be deeply unhealthy because you need calcium, carbohydrate.
It's not enough energy for starters.
You need all sorts of... You need all the different nutrients available to be healthy. Sleep's like that. Deep sleep, yes, it's important, but so is light sleep. So is REM sleep. They are all important parts, like a plate of food, a balanced plate of food. And for people to obsess that deep sleep is the important part is ridiculous, because A, you can't control it, really, and B, it's just part of sleep. And we can never know how we slept unless we have a polysomnography recording our brain. So for that gentleman, he needs to not worry about getting more deep sleep, because it's all important parts. Yeah. But the fact that he wakes up feeling unrefreshed, that's not great. Now, it could mean, does he only feel unrefreshed for the first 10, 15 minutes after waking? Because if so, that's probably sleep inertia. And he's probably waking up from a deeper part of sleep, waking up still feeling sleepy. But if an hour after waking, he feels fine and he is fine for the rest of the day, I'm not worried about
and
that.
And a nutritional note, hydrate, hydrate, hydrate when you wake up, please. People just don't do that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
However, if his tiredness and fatigue continues through the day and he's getting 7 to 9 hours sleep, then that says to me, okay, maybe the sleep quality you're getting isn't good enough. In which case, the number one reason across the sort of world that could be the cause of that is something called sleep apnea. And sleep apnea is a breathing disorder during the sleep when you repeatedly stop breathing during the night. And every time you stop breathing, your oxygen content goes down in your blood until your brain realizes, oh my goodness, we're not breathing. It wakes you up, big surge of adrenaline, and you go back to sleep again.
I have a family member with that. They have to sleep with a box.
Yeah, with a CPAP machine. Mm. Now, the point is, with sleep apnea, you could wake up hundreds of times in the night, but you won't remember waking up because you weren't awake for 2 minutes when you woke up to remember to store that memory. So for this gentleman, he might think he sleeps solidly for 7 to 9 hours, but in fact, he might be waking up repeatedly with something like sleep apnea. So if you are getting enough sleep and feeling fatigued during the day, not just after waking, speak to your doctor, because you might need to have a sleep assessment to find out what's going on, to figure out, you know, why is the quality sleep you're getting, which should be enough, not enough.
Wow. Do you see, we can actually speak to our doctor about that sort of thing, which I think a lot of people are not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that it was that simple to get an assessment about sleep from your GP.
Definitely. If you have those symptoms, especially if you snore a lot, you wake up gasping for breath, these are all signs, potential signs of sleep apnea.
That's so interesting. Thank you so much. What a good question, Ian. That was good. Kirsty, I like this. Are daylight lamps beneficial in the winter? So, you know, you get those sad lamps.
Absolutely. So they are great.
Okay.
Now, not for everybody, because there are situations where you shouldn't use one. But basically, a sad lamp, which stands for seasonal affective disorder, is a bright light box or a bright lamp, which like floods you with bright daylight. Now, I'm a big fan of free. I really am. If there is a way to fix a problem for free,
yeah,
please do it. And the reality is, if you can go outside, that's free and you'll get sunshine.
Fresh air.
But yeah, admittedly, we live in the Northern Hemisphere. In the winter, it might be cold, snowing, or you might have a job, or you might be a shift worker and be unable to get outside in the bright sunshine. In which case, an SAD lamp or a light box can be really helpful. It can be helpful for your mood, because that's why they're called SAD, seasonal affective disorder, which is the winter blues a winter depression.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah.
And light can help us feel happier. But it also can help us be more awake during the day, because our melatonin, we produce melatonin when there's darkness. And if you're at home and it's winter and you're not really getting any bright light exposure, your brain doesn't really know, is it daytime, is it not? I'm not really sure. So if you give yourself lots of really bright light from one of these light boxes, your brain's like, oh yes, my goodness, it's definitely daytime. We should be really awake and alert, and we should conversely be sleeping later in the evening. Now, with a light box, there are some caveats, because when you put it on is important, because you don't want to put it on at the wrong time. If you put it on in the evening, your brain's going to go, oh, look, it must be midday, all this light.
Surely to start the day, yeah.
If you are, say, 50, 60, 70 years old, putting it on first thing in the morning maybe isn't helpful, because as we get older, our circadian rhythm starts to shift earlier, and getting bright light exposure too early can mean that you're shifting your circadian rhythm even more, and you'll start waking up at 3 in the morning and falling asleep at 6 p.m.
Don't want that.
So it depends on, when you use it is important. As a general rule, if you're struggling to fall asleep in the evening, so you go to bed but it takes you an hour or two to fall asleep, use it first thing in the morning. If you're falling asleep too early and waking up too early, use it later in the day.
Okay.
And I'd say use it for, build it up slowly. Use it for 30 minutes to an hour a day at most. But if you have something like bipolar disorder, epilepsy, you should speak to your doctor, because those are definitely, you shouldn't use an SAD box with those conditions.
And surely there must be a quality control check, I guess. So definitely speak to your doctor on where you're buying these from, what ones they are. Are they even the right light that you need? I don't really understand. Yeah. But
so you
surely
can spend hundreds of pounds on one, or you can buy a cheap one for £30.
Fine.
As long as they do the right job, you don't need to spend hundreds of pounds on one.
Wow. It's absolutely fascinating, the subject of sleep in itself. And another question we've got here is about nightmares, which I think is really helpful. So Tim has said, is there a way of reducing the frequency of nightmares or stressful dreams? And is that the processing in the day?
Yeah, kind of. So absolutely. If you're having nightmares, there's a sign that there's something going on in your life you need to deal with. Maybe writing therapy, which again is free, just write stuff down, or talk to a friend, or talk to a counsellor, or look at your life and think, well, okay, is there something really stressful I'm not dealing with, and I need to maybe change my job or change this aspect. But if you're having repeated nightmares that have the same kind of plot, then there's a really good thing called nightmare rescripting or dream rescripting therapy, which is used in PTSD. And what this is that you think about the last bad dream that you had. So this person, think about, okay, what was the bad dream you had last night? Bring it to mind during the day. Think about it. And then what we want to do is we want to re-script that in our mind, as in change it. Because when we have a bad dream, we feel powerless. I'm having a bad dream, I'm being chased by a monster, it's going to eat me and I'm really scared and I wake up. During the day, what I want you to do is to recall that bad dream. Okay, I'm being chased by a monster. But practice changing it, re-script it, as if you were a script writer.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining I'm being chased by a monster and I'm running down the road, and out of the doors, loads of puppies come running out.
Yeah, yeah.
And they start running to me and licking me, and I'm ticklish. And they run up to the monster and they start tickling the monster.
Yeah.
And then lots of balloons fall out the sky. And then you just change it to something silly, comic, cute. Practice doing that during the day. And then at night, when you're having the bad dreams, you're sort of setting those neural pathways. You're training your brain how to change a bad dream into a good one.
It's invaluably helpful. I can only imagine as well, for parents listening as well, about children that get nightmares. What I've taken away from this, so I should have saved it for the food for thought at the end, is that, you know, when my children get to that stage, we need to talk a lot more in the day and try and process everything. And is it true the brain does a lot of cleaning out when we're asleep? I've read about, and the difference between grey, if you could touch on grey matter, or does that make a difference?
Sure, well, grey matter is the part of our brain that we use to think. And so our brain, there was a study in 2019 that used neural imaging, so a machine to look at, physically look inside the brain while someone was sleeping.
Yeah.
And this is the most fascinating piece of research. So we've known for a long time.
In 2019?
Yeah.
Not that long ago.
So there's been lots of, we know that not getting enough sleep has been associated with an increased risk of Alzheimer's dementia. So we know that not getting enough sleep, dementia, hand in hand. But why? And this neuroimaging study showed that when we're asleep, we have these we have a cerebrospinal fluid, and channels open up to the brain during our sleep, and this fluid physically washes over our brain and physically spring cleans, basically, and washes away these things called amyloid plaques. And amyloid plaques are these sticky substances that build up in the brain, and when we're asleep, the cerebrospinal fluid physically washes them away. And we know that a build-up of amyloid plaques is linked to Alzheimer's. Yeah. Now, the point is, this is what's so important, if you're not getting enough sleep, your brain doesn't have time to do all of these things. It's like when we're stressed. If you're busy and stressed, your bathroom, cleaning your bathroom, isn't your priority. You think, well, I'll do that when I need to feed the kids and I need to take the dog for a walk and do this, but that'll have to wait. And that's fine in the short term. But what if you are so stressed that you don't clean your bathroom for weeks, months, years? Imagine the build-up of disgustingness in your bathroom. And this is what happens with our brain. If we don't get enough sleep for a night or two, or a season of our lives because we're dealing with young children or whatever, it's not amazing, but it's not the end of the world. It's when we continue to not get enough sleep long term that
chronically these
things start to build up to a stage where it's so negative for our health.
Gosh, everybody, we need to be prioritising our sleep, which leads me on to a fun bit of the podcast. Well, you might not think it's fun. The fact or fiction round. Are you ready, Lindsay?
Okay,
if you could answer fact or fiction to the following. Your body gets used to a lack of sleep.
Fiction. You can cope with it, but it's not... You don't get used to it. It doesn't like make it okay. You can get used to eating McDonald's every single meal.
Good analogy. A nap after lunch can be beneficial for the brain and help to boost energy levels.
Absolutely, yes, true.
Men are more likely to experience poor sleep.
No, opposite. Women. Sorry.
Oh, it sucks. There are foods which can help you sleep.
Yes, things like complex carbohydrates that will slow release energy during the night. Much better for sort of helping you through the night. And things like nuts that contain tryptophan, which is like a precursor of melatonin.
Fantastic. You should maintain your regular sleep routine on holiday.
Yes, in an ideal world. But then again, we don't live in an ideal world, do we? It's not like the world is perfect. So yes, absolutely. We should continue eating healthily and exercising regularly whilst on holiday, but we don't. Same with sleep.
No, it's true. I've had a few clients that have to cross time zones for work frequently and they stay on the same time. And I just don't know how they do it, but it's fascinating. Alcohol does not have any effect on the quality of sleep.
Completely untrue. It really does.
Let's touch on that after. We sleep better when we go to bed and wake up the same time every day.
Absolutely, yes, true.
You should get up as soon as your alarm goes off.
Absolutely true. Yes, please do that, everyone. It's so important.
Sleeping on your back has no advantages.
No, there are advantages and disadvantages for all sorts of different ways of sleeping.
Is it possible to grow out of insomnia?
To grow out of it?
Mm.
Well, that's an interesting turn of phrase. Mm. It's possible to get past it, for sure, if your lifestyle changes and you're not stressed anymore.
That's a fantastic fact or fiction round. I want to touch on several points. Alcohol, just quickly. I know a lot of people had it dehydrates, but what is the impact on sleep?
Sure. Well, actually, alcohol is a sedative, so it actually helps you fall asleep. So you might think, oh, great, I'll start drinking. And lots of people do. However, it's like robbing Peter to pay Paul. When you drink alcohol, it changes your sleep cycles. It changes how you sleep. So what happens is you might fall asleep or pass out for 3 hours, but then your sleep continuity for the rest of the night is ruined because alcohol really disrupts the quality of your sleep. So don't use alcohol to help you sleep.
Getting up at the same time every day, basically. Yeah. And what about clock changes? I should have asked you about clock changes. I can't stand clock changes. Yeah. Is there any benefit to them? Why do we do it?
Well, the main benefit was because when children had to walk to school, when parents didn't have cars and we lived in a society where people walked everywhere, if it's dark in the morning, then children might get run over by cars. So we have the clock changed to make it lighter earlier so that children don't die. So that's very good and important. However, our bodies don't adapt well to clock changes.
It's horrendous with kids.
Yeah.
And it's awful.
It's interesting because actually the clock change when we lose an hour's sleep for adults is actually great for parents because children can't tell the time, so they sleep in. And when the other clock change happens, when we gain an hour's sleep, parents with young children, it doesn't matter at all. So the point is, we should prepare for the clock change the few days before. So start moving towards the new time zone by 15, 20 minutes every sort of for 2, 3, 4 days before the clock change, so that when the clocks change, nothing will, you know, your body will go and will go to bed at the normal time, wake up at what it thinks is the normal time, and everything is perfect. So
I'm glad you
planning.
Said that, because that's what I have done. And people are like, I can't believe you're taking the effort to do that.
It's great.
It's made such a difference to my lifestyle and the kids.
And also you should do it with young children going on holiday.
Yeah.
Because if you go on holiday to, you know, Greece or whatever, and it's even if it's just a 2-3 hour time difference, if you have young children, that's huge. So if you can move your young children to the new time zone before holiday, or at least partway there, it makes things a lot easier.
What about keeping them on? So I'm thinking, what if the routine goes from, sorry, I'm just asking loads of personal advice, but it's my podcast, 7 to 7, and what if it goes to 9 to 9? Does that matter when you're on holiday for a week or...
No, not at all.
Okay,
no, it's
good to know.
Fine.
Fantastic. Oh, there's so many questions for you, Lindsay, but that does wrap up our episode. I'm devastated because I want to keep talking about sleep. We finish with a food for thought. And I think mine today is that this conversation we've had has really hammered home for me the importance of looking after our brains and the fact that sleep does that massively for health outcomes, like you've mentioned, with neurodegenerative diseases like dementia, Alzheimer's, the umbrella. Looking at, I guess, our heart health, our sleep health. Sleep is a big deal. And too often, I believe it's brushed off in society. Drink loads of coffee, crack on. I have to say, from a nutritionist point of view, more than 2 to 3 cups in my mind a day is just not ideal. What is your take-home message on food for thought today?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about that sleep shouldn't be something that you just don't prioritise, because if you prioritise your sleep, you're going to be happier, you're going to be healthier, you're going to be more efficient. If you're not sleeping because you think you should do all the things around the house or be superwoman or superman, but then you're neglecting your sleep, you're actually going to get sicker and your family will have to look after you. You're going to not be as productive at work. You're going to put your health at risk. It makes sense to put your oxygen mask on yourself before helping others. So get enough sleep so that you are the best you that you can be to help your family and friends and be the best at work.
Wow. Wow, what an episode. Lindsay, thank you for coming on Food for Thought. Where can our listeners go to find out more about the amazing work that you do?
Oh, sure. So I'm on all social media at Dr. Browning Sleep, Dr. Browning Sleep. And my website is troublesleeping.co.uk, and they can read my self-help sleep book, which has got lots of really useful information about how to help yourself sleep, which is called Navigating Sleeplessness.
Amazing. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right, that's it. If you're enjoying Food for Thought, you will love what we have coming up in future episodes, I have no doubt. So if you're not already, you just have to hit the subscribe button on your podcast app. So this means you get a little notification bell. I wish I'd known about it earlier, so you don't miss out on the new episode. And it comes out every single Monday. We've been doing Mondays since the start of Food for Thought. We're now on series 16. There is a lot of misinformation out there, and I really hope that we're continuing to bring you the latest research along with our special guests to ensure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
that you're just getting the best experience possible. So if you are enjoying our episodes and you're learning lots, then please do leave us a review or get in touch. This will help enormously and ultimately help us reach more people and make sure we're doing the right thing by you and giving you the right information. So if you want to learn more about the best-selling books, the clinic, perhaps you need to book in to see one of our fantastic clinicians, or to find out more about Retrition Plus, you can find everything you need to know on retrition.com. And you can follow, of course, me on Retrition on all social media platforms. Yes, I'm even on TikTok now, guys. So you can head over there and check it out.